couple bits of economic news here that are being interpreted generally in a positive fashion. If you own a home, for example, home prices grew modestly in May in the United States. You've heard of the Standard & Poor's Case-Shiller U.S. National Home Price Index. It posted a 5% annual growth in May, the same as in April. Still, I guess, annual gains there in terms of the appreciation of the value of homes. Annual gains are flattening out over a longer period. And consumer confidence held steady in July. A slight dip, but still considered pretty strong there. Current state here on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Glad you could join us here today. We are going to be heading off to Philadelphia here today in the next few minutes. Last week, of course, Republicans nominated Donald Trump for president at their national convention in Cleveland. This week, it's the Democrats' turn. Last night, they nominated Hillary Clinton for president in Philly. We're going to talk with a couple of Michigan delegates to the Democratic National Convention. In a few minutes, we'll talk with Bernie Sanders delegate Mark Lachey. First, though, we have on the line Chris Savage. He's a Hillary Clinton delegate from Dexter and the chairman of the Washtenaw County Democrats. Chris Savage, welcome to Current State.
Thanks, Scott. Welcome. Glad to be here.
It's Mark Bayshore on this end, Chris. Just FYI, why Hillary Clinton and not Bernie Sanders?
Well, I have to say I've been a supporter of Hillary Clinton for quite some time. I just have found her to be a woman of great integrity, and she has a long legacy, more than three decades of public service, in the issues that I feel very strongly about. So I'm looking forward to seeing her be Madam President, and I think she's probably the most qualified person to hold that office that I've ever seen, maybe in history.
As Bernie Sanders' support grew throughout the primary process, or at least held steady, he clearly had a core of very ardent supporters. Was there a point at which you considered backing Bernie Sanders?
Yeah, I would say that I, until probably just the beginning of this year, I was still, weighing my options. And I will say that I am a strong supporter of Bernie Sanders, whether he won the nomination or not. He represents, a really fresh approach to politics. I think he's also a man of high integrity, and I really look forward to him continuing to build the movement that he's begun here with his campaign and really doing some amazing things. I thought Joe Biden said it best the other night when he said that Bernie Sanders changed the Democratic Party more than the Democratic Party changed Bernie Sanders, and I think that's exactly right. So,
has there been a highlight in Philadelphia for you so far?
Last night's speeches were just amazingly inspiring. I was just texting with my wife, and we both just came away very emotional after last night. I thought the Sandra Bland's mother and the others from the Mothers Movement were just, I had tears streaming down my cheeks as I was listening to them. It was very powerful to hear them. It was called the Mothers of the Movement, and they just were so powerful, and they really highlighted that, why we are a great country now. We can be better. We've got changes to make it a more perfect union, and their support of Hillary Clinton is very gratifying.
I have to agree. I think to see the produced piece of those moms, which was very well done, and then to see them all on stage together was pretty dramatic.
It really was.
Describe the atmosphere here, though, amongst the Michigan delegates here. Are the Clinton and Sanders people getting along? What are those interactions like?
Yeah, in general, it's always tough when your candidate doesn't win. So there's certainly some folks that are still upset, and there's certainly been some. The WikiLeaks thing has really made some folks really upset. So, we're getting, some people are still, questioning things. But in general, I think that, our delegation is going to come out of this unified. I think we all realize that Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders both support more issues together than they're separate on it. They voted something like 93% of the time together in the Senate, for example. So the issues that we all care about are common. So I'm looking forward to us, working together. And, I think if you come to the Democratic Convention, you're probably, you've got Democratic roots in you. So, I think we'll come out of this together.
We're talking with Chris Savage of Dexter, Michigan. Chris is a Hillary Clinton delegate. On the phone with us here from Philadelphia. He is chairman of the Washtenaw County Democrats as well. How do you, respond to the arguments that Hillary Clinton has a serious issue in terms of trust?
I find it a little confusing because I just don't see the evidence of that. I mean, all the things that they throw at her about, you know, the speeches to Wall Street and these kinds of things, you know, I understand why that seems on its surface to be something that's worrisome, but if you look at her record, she's never done anything that would suggest that she is, for example, in the pocket of big banks or, you know, that she is, you know, somehow corrupted by all of this. And if you look at her long legacy, and I think that was the main message last night at the convention was, you know, the proof is in her actions. You have to judge her by her actions. And the things that she has done over the last 30, 35 years, the things that Bill Clinton spelled out in his dramatically long speech last night, you know, that's what I look at. And so that my response to them is, I understand that you don't like what the appearance is, but look at what she has done and look at what she has accomplished. And she's just, like I said, she's the most eminently qualified person for this position. And don't we want good, solid, progressive people on the boards of these big banks to be our voice there? Because, you know, if the only people that are on there are the people that we don't like, then nothing will ever change. So she's been a change agent, and, you know, that's really largely why I'm a huge supporter of her.
Some Sanders supporters have become, I think, understandably fed up with the primary process here. You alluded to the email to the email situation here. Some of them have taken to social media to express that displeasure. I'm looking at a tweet here from a Jive Chalusky, who says, and I will quote, "Bernie Sanders wins the Michigan primary. Months later, Hillary Clinton gets a sizable win in Michigan. Our votes are only suggestions," unquote. My question for you, Chris, does the primary process for the Democrats need changing?
I haven't formed a solid opinion about open versus closed primaries and caucuses versus primaries and that type of thing. But what I will say is that I think that the primary process is a very robust and important thing. You know, during the last governor's campaign, I was supportive of the Democrats not having a primary for the governor because it allows us to conserve our resources and it doesn't beat up our candidate, blah, blah, blah. But I do think that Mark Schauer would have been a stronger candidate in the general election had he gone through a challenge in the primary. And I came out of 2014 feeling much more, as much as I hate primaries because it always pits my friends against each other as a Democrat, I really think it does sharpen us. It focuses us. And in the case of the Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders primary campaigns, it has really, you know, it has pushed our party to the left thanks to Bernie Sanders. And I think that's important. I'm a pretty solid progressive myself, so I'm very happy to see that movement.
Chris Savage is the chairman of the Democratic Party in Washtenaw County and a Hillary Clinton delegate to the Democratic National Convention. He's been on the phone with us from Philadelphia. Thank you, Chris.
Thanks a lot, Scott.
Our next guest is Mark Lachey. Mark went to the convention committed to Bernie Sanders. He's an attorney from Saugatuck who chairs the Michigan Democratic Party's LGBTQ caucus. Lachey is also on the MDP State Central Committee and Executive Committees and a board member of the Victory Fund PAC. Mark Lachey, welcome to Current State.
Thank you, Mark. Good to be with you.
Let's clarify at the outset who you voted for yesterday. You went to the convention committed to Bernie Sanders. Who got your vote?
Bernie Sanders all the way.
And why did you prefer him over Hillary Clinton?
If the question is why did I vote for him last evening, I believe because I was sent here to represent a sizable portion of literally millions of votes in Michigan that supported him, and I felt the obligation in part to continue that. I am a Democrat who supported Bernie, but in that order, and I am now fully supportive of Hillary Clinton. I supported Bernie because he inspired me, not that Hillary didn't, but I am thrilled that where Hillary is now, quite candidly, is not necessarily where her campaign was when she started in terms of her positions. We have an incredibly progressive platform. We have important changes to the rules going forward. I think there has been a needed shakeup at the DNC. So once I voted for Bernie and I agreed with Bernie completely in terms of his support for Hillary, the rest of the evening I was cheering for Hillary, and I will be thrilled to cheer her on Thursday night at the convention here.
Describe the process for you, though, in terms of shifting your allegiance. Can you describe for us what that's been like?
Well, they talk about X number of stages of grief, and I went through some of those, to be quite honest with you. It was a head and heart kind of thing. I think pretty early on in the primary process, and quite candidly before Michigan, I saw in my head part, I saw the tea leaves that I honestly, candidly believed that Bernie was going to probably not succeed. The heart part of me stayed true to him until at least through the New York primary, relatively late in the process, certainly through Michigan. I was thrilled, ecstatic that Bernie won Michigan. Again, I just go to, I was supportive of Hillary, and I am again, but in terms of Bernie's message and what he was doing with respect to expanding the base of voter turnout, not just with the cliche millennials that everybody's talking about, but I looked across Michigan. I live in West Michigan, as you mentioned, and I saw an uprising of an involvement and engagement of people who felt that they were outside the process, never able to get into the process, and for the first time were motivated to get active and get into the political and democratic process. Capital D on the democratic process.
Got it. Some Sanders delegates left the floor as a protest. How did you feel about those that did, and if I mean, were you among them?
No, I was not among them, and I saw press reports that they left in droves. I can tell you from at least the Michigan delegation, it was a handful. I had mixed emotions. I felt sorry. I felt happy for the Bernie supporters, and there were some diehards who stayed. Some I would characterize them as Bernie or bust people who stayed. And I think those people recognized the significance of the event that they're attending, the significance of, regardless of whether it's nominating, which is hugely historic and important, of course, nominating the first woman to be president of the United States, but you're simply in a presidential convention. And that's very rarefied air. There's 100 or so of us from Michigan representing the entire state in an arena of very relatively few people when you consider how many Democrats there are in our country. And that's an exciting, exciting once-in-a-lifetime kind of moment, especially for a contested convention.
Right.
So I felt bad. I understood, but I felt bad for those people who were so wrapped up in the Bernie moment that they felt that they could not stay and continue to participate and enjoy and fully grasp the historic nature of simply attending a presidential convention and a contested one at that, which I a few years ago, I would have bet good money we would never see a contested convention again, and I was very surprised this time.
What do you think the longer-term future of the party is, especially in the wake of the Wasserman-Schultz incidents indicating resistance to your guy, Bernie Sanders?
I'll bring it closer to home. I'll talk about the Michigan Democratic Party. I think in order for us to not repeat the losses of 2010 and 2014, we need to diversify and broaden the base and the reach of the Michigan Democratic Party. We need to reach into constituencies that quite candidly may have been taken for granted as Democratic voters or have just not been looked to as potential Democratic voters. And I think there is a movement within the powers that be, an acknowledgement and movement within the powers that be of the Michigan Democratic Party to diversify and broaden that base, and so that not only do we win in the presidential years, but we win in the off-year elections. So I'm very gratified with that, but to me, that is one of the messages that Bernie was talking about. Of course, he was talking, he was talking from top down, but actually it's the opposite. He repeatedly talked about from bottom up, and that talks about county parties, and that's talking about state parties. It is not about the DNC as much as I think what happened with W. Wasserman Schultz was a reflection of some things that happened that probably shouldn't. But the more important issue is at the state level and the county level and the local club level. And that was one of the reasons I supported Bernie, was because he was talking about, let's change the process, let's broaden the appeal, and let's elect more Democrats, let's elect more progressives.
We've got 30 seconds left here, Mark. Do you have a personal highlight moment from the convention so far?
Boy. The nominating process, I mean, the roll call, I thought was quite gratifying in terms of some of the personal anecdotes from different states. Bernie being emotional when he spoke a couple nights ago, and then last night when he spoke on behalf of Vermont. And the other thing real quick, well, I saw Bernie speak, and I was like 2 feet away from Susan Sarandon. I went, oh, my God, there's Susan Sarandon. So anyway...
Hey, it's been good to talk to you. We want to thank Mark Lachey. He went to the convention committed to Bernie Sanders. He's an attorney from Saugatuck who chairs the Michigan Democratic Party's LGBTQ caucus. Thank you, Mark Lachey.
Thank you, Mark, very much.
Coming up on Current State, Legal Services of South Central Michigan provides free civil legal assistance to low-income persons contending with homelessness, domestic violence, and other challenges here in Ingham and 12 other counties. We'll learn more about its mission and the challenges of the people it helps from the group's supervising attorney, Elizabeth Rios. That's coming up. Well, we're in the midst of summer driving season. These are the days for long car trips to great getaway spots and also just the routine trips to the grocery store or the gas station. Parents of teenaged children know the talks they have with their kids as they get behind the wheel for the first time, but there's another conversation experts say families should be having. This one is with older loved ones who may be reaching a time when they should no longer be driving. A national in-home senior care franchise is sponsoring a program to help families initiate that conversation. I'm joined today by Wynn Esterline, the owner of Home Instead Senior Care of East Lansing. Wynn, welcome to Current State.
Well, thank you, Mark. I appreciate the opportunity to be here with you.
Well, it's an interesting and challenging topic. Is there a right time for families to talk with their elderly loved ones about stopping driving or driving less,
sure,
at least?
Yeah. You know, there is no perfect time. You know, there are certainly some signals that we should be aware of when spending time with our older loved ones that may give us some indications that, you know, maybe that conversation needs to be had.
But that's just, I guess, the time boils down to, I guess, every situation is slightly different,
I would imagine. It is.
And
one of the things, I've been, you know, in the home care business for 16 years and gone through this with grandparents. And, you know, what's so challenging about it and to have this conversation is uncomfortable. And, you know, here oftentimes the children say, you know, it's my parent and I don't want to, the role reversal can be very challenging. But when you see the time, you know, when they start to have some medical conditions, if they have macular degeneration or some of these things that are going to impair their vision, there's also with, you know, cognitive impairments with dementia. These are some real, these are really blatant signs that,
right,
that we need to be having this conversation.
How should the topic be raised? What advice would you have for an adult?
Yeah, I think, you know, no matter how you do it, you need to say it with love. You know, you need to come from a place that you really love them. You're more concerned about their well-being as well as the others on the road. And you know, I think just having, you know, a cup of coffee, having a conversation with them. And what some of the statistics have come back with some of the surveys that we've done at Home Instead is that the reality is once we have the conversation, it actually decreases their anxiety because they're concerned as well but they, you know, but they don't want to talk about it.
But still, I'm sure there are situations where families encounter resistance.
Well, there is no question. My grandfather, just a very quick story.
Sure.
He would tell me, you know, when you take my keys, you might as well just put me in the grave.
Oh, boy.
You know, the loss of that independence,
freedom,
freedom, you know, is really difficult. But once we start the conversation, and we don't have to, it's not an automatic, we're going to take the keys and you can no longer drive. If we wait too long, that's the conversation.
Can you wean an older person from driving when that, I mean, is there a process here as opposed to a drop dead, bad choice of word, drop dead date?
Yeah. But. Well, you know, I think, yeah, I mean, as a family, you need to put a plan in place and starting that conversation and just saying, you know, maybe we should not drive at night. You know, let's start with not driving at night. And then there's other times where, you know, let's stay away from rush hour or let's stay away from, you know, campus when the kids are coming back or the kids are leaving when it's really hectic.
Yeah.
You know, those are different things. And also maybe even saying, you know, go to the grocery, which is just down the road, but we don't want to be driving, you know, across town. Some of those things. And when we're having this conversation, we want to create another option for them. So if they do want to go across town or across state or to their cabin up north, you know, maybe family can, rally around and go with them and do the driving. You also, there's services out there where we're all hectic and with our jobs and, you know, mom and dad's doctor's appointments smack dab in the middle of the day. And, you know, you can call, you know, Home Instead Senior Care and we can arrange to have somebody come and pick them up, take them in, you know, which is different than a taxi. You know, taxi is a curb to curb. But if you have a service like Home Instead Senior Care, we're going to go in, you know, to the home, help them get around, get in the car, go with them into the doctor's office, you know, so that it can be a little bit easier with them, or easier for them, rather.
We're talking about ways for families to start the conversation with their elderly loved ones about easing them off the roads. And when the time is right, my guest is Wynn Esterline, owner of Home Instead Senior Care in East Lansing. We're talking about a national program called Let's Talk About Driving. What are, let's go a little bit deeper here into these warning signs here that might indicate a problem.
Some of the warning signs is really about when you're riding in the vehicle with your loved one.
Hmm.
You know, it's really important, even before you get in the car, do a once around the car. And is there any dents, scrapes, things that may be obvious that maybe they have, you know,
and they're keeping it from you.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, the thought, like my grandfather, you know, the thought of losing those keys is really scary.
Yeah.
Other things is, you know, when you're with them, you know, are they increased irritation, you know, because of, you know, always blaming the other driver or something along those lines is, you know, maybe something's not quite right. And also their judgment, you know, turning left, you know, maybe, you know, you're wondering, oh boy, you know, that was a poor choice.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those things are some of the warning signs that you want to be really aware of.
I imagine that presenting alternatives could be persuasive in situations like this. What are some of those alternatives that somebody might put out on the table just to soften this a little bit?
Yes, it is critically important to make sure that you're still allowing them to be as independent as possible. You know, you still want, my grandmother, she had her Friday hair appointment, and by gosh, if she were to miss that, you know, the sky would be falling. So we want to make sure that we make sure that we have somebody that can take them to those things that are very important, still giving them that freedom to go to the hair, you know, go to get their hair done, go play bridge with the group of, you know, their friends that they've done forever. You want to maintain that independence and allowing them to continue to do all of those things that they have been, you know, doing.
We've just got less than a minute here, but I want to ask you one question that I just am really curious about. We're hearing lots more about new self-driving technologies in cars. Have you begun to process that? I mean, are there ways that can, are there, do you imagine ways in the future that technological advances that might enable older people to stay driving longer?
I think that is one of the best things that has happened for older adults. You know, a lot of times they have that, you know, that car they've had forever, but it doesn't have any of these assistive devices, like, you know, the warning signs when you're parking, or, you know, I just got a new vehicle, and when I'm driving down the road and between the lines I get too close to one, my seat vibrates to tell me, hey, you're getting too close.
Right.
I think those different technologies, you know, do an upgrade, you know, to a vehicle that has some of these features, or also just see if you can have some of these put into their car. And I think that's going to allow them to be safer, independent on the road.
We have been discussing the national Let's Talk About Driving program. It's an initiative designed to help families talk with their elderly loved ones about transitioning them off the roads, away from behind the wheel, when the time is right. Wynn Esterline is the owner of Home Instead Senior Care in East Lansing. Thank you, Wynn.
Thank you very much.
Coming up on Current State, Peter Frampton will forever hold a place in the hearts of his fans. 13 million people bought Frampton Comes Alive in the 1970s. Current State Scott Pohl talks with the guitar legend ahead of his return to Michigan this week. That's coming up. Yeah, I'm glad we dropped that bit in about our next pop-up stories. The Call of the Wild is the theme of our storytelling event tomorrow evening, 7 to 8:30 or thereabouts. Brooke Allen of WKAR will host that. I'll be there. Most of our team will be there. We hope to see you at Valley Court Park, East Lansing, between 7 and 8:30, and that's just before the City of East Lansing's movie. At 9:30. There can be no equal justice where the kind of trial one enjoys depends on the amount of money one has. That 1956 quote by former Supreme Court Justice Hugo Black is at the top of Legal Services of South Central Michigan's website, and it informs their mission. LSSCM provides free legal advice and representation in certain civil cases to low-income persons and senior citizens in 13 Michigan counties. The Lansing office serves the Tri-County area, plus Livingston and Shiawassee counties. For Neighbors in Action this week, we're joined by Elizabeth Rios, supervising attorney for LSSCM. Elizabeth, welcome to Current State.
Good morning, Mark. Thank you for having me.
Give us kind of your elevator speech here in terms of what's the meat and potatoes of what you do at this organization.
Well, I'd say the meat and potatoes of what we do is advocating and representing low-income individuals to the best of our ability, with the idea that we would do it with the same force and effect of a large law firm. And we do civil legal services in the areas of family law, housing, public benefits, consumer law, and elder law in those five counties that you just mentioned.
So of all those services that you offer, which are the ones most needed here in the Lansing area?
So the highest volume of calls that we receive would be family first, I would say followed in a close second place by housing.
Okay, and what kinds of family issues are you likely to get involved in?
So the types of family law cases that we take for full representation are divorces, custody actions, and personal protection orders, with a priority placed on survivors of domestic violence for full representation.
And on the housing piece, what about that?
And for housing, we place a priority on preventing homelessness, whether that be someone who is at risk of losing their home to foreclosure or at risk of losing their housing to eviction for either non-payment of rent or for a termination of tenancy, which is an alleged violation of their lease that the landlord is trying to evict them for.
Let's clarify here, too. We're not talking about pro bono legal work. This is an organization with a staff of full-time attorneys this is their gig full-time.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we do have a very helpful, and we're very grateful for, pro bono attorney panel that we have a partnership through the private bar, but our office is staffed by 7 staff attorneys, myself as supervising attorney, and Kelly Mackey, our managing attorney. And no matter where you're at in the country, there is a legal aid that is staffed by attorneys that will serve that county.
Mm. Sounds like really rewarding work.
I love it. I wouldn't trade it for anything.
How long have you been with the organization?
I've been with Legal Services since 2008, okay. And it's the reason I went to law school. So okay. I'm very grateful that I get to do this work.
Can you imagine practicing law in a different, in a more, what do I say, retail environment?
In a more
after 8 years
sense.
Here?
Absolutely not. I really would not trade it for any other type of legal job.
Talk to us about who qualifies here exactly. What kind of hurdles do they have to leap in terms of income, that kind of thing?
Right. So when someone is experiencing some kind of legal issue, they can call our intake line. They can contact our office. We also do referrals through community organizations. And the first sort of screening is their legal issue one of the five civil legal areas that I mentioned? We don't do criminal law. We don't do abuse and neglect cases. Pretty much anything that the state would otherwise provide you with an attorney if you were indigent. So those are kind of the priorities that are placed on us by the federal regulations.
Understood.
And then in addition, there's the income screening. So we are able to help anybody that is 125% to 200% of the poverty line or below.
So for a family of four, I want to say the poverty line's, is it $24,000?
It's right around there, okay. Yes. I think for a single person, it's like just under $12,000.
So you're saying 125% of that?
Yes. Well, that would be the 125% of poverty is the, I think, 11.9 is it for a single person.
Okay.
Now, that's not to say that we're not able to help somebody that has over 200% if we have other funding. So if we have a local grant, if we have a state grant, then we're able to still assist that person even if they're above 200% if we can use something other than the federal funding we receive.
And how does your organization connect with the people that you help? There's a referral process, I take it, that's in play much of the time.
Yes. So we have the intake hotline number that we distribute throughout the communities in which we serve. And then we work very closely with community organizations, with the domestic violence shelter here, Eve, and the other shelters in our other service areas. We work very closely with Volunteers of America. We work very closely with the other homeless shelters. We work very closely with the continuums of care in each of the counties that we serve and are willing to receive referrals from any and all of those organizations.
But do you take walk-ins?
We do take walk-ins, but in very rare circumstances. Mm-hmm. We take walk-ins if the legal issue is emergent at that moment. So if someone is calling us or walks in and says the sheriff is at my door, I'm about to be evicted, literally, or my children were not returned according to the custody order that has been signed by the court.
I gotcha. Okay, so you're apt to swing into action suddenly in some cases.
Yes, absolutely.
We'll point out this intake number, by the way. It's toll-free, 888-783-8190, 1-888-783-8190. I'm speaking with Elizabeth Rio, Supervising Attorney for Legal Services of South Central Michigan, for current state's Neighbors in Action here today. With all the requests for legal help that you get, are you able to meet the demand?
No, unfortunately, no. I mean, the simple answer is sadly no. I would love to have a staff of like 100 attorneys and able to serve every single person that is indigent, because I feel very strongly about the, you know, quote that you read at the beginning of the segment, that, you know, somebody's access to justice should not be determined by the amount of money that they have. So we're constantly trying to figure out ways to use to help more people with the resources that we have. So we've recently started eviction diversion programs in two of our counties that I'm really proud of and extremely excited about.
Eviction diversion. Okay.
Yep. So okay. Primarily focused in the housing right. aspect of our legal issue area.
How many employees do you have?
Well, we have seven staff attorneys, myself, the supervising attorney, and Kelly Mackey, our managing attorney. We also have two support staff and an office/grant manager. And then we usually have usually around 10 law students or undergrad students volunteering, externing with us at any one period of time, which we rely on and value very much.
How many cases do you have in an average year?
Well, each of our attorneys carries, I would say, on an average of 40 cases at any one period of time at various stages of litigation. And we do...
Oh, close to 300 a year then.
For each, well, at any one period of time. We've done about 2,500 cases in our office with both advice and representation.
Since the beginning?
Yes.
Okay. You also have online services that can walk people through how to get advice and help. How does that work?
So, yes, we our program, the Michigan Advocacy Program, has recently, in the last couple of years, started the Michigan Legal Help site, which is online and is available to anybody regardless of income guidelines. And basically, they are toolkits, a series of questions that someone can answer regarding divorce, regarding expungement, regarding eviction, regarding a consumer debt case. And at the end of those answers, the program will print out the forms that they would then need to file in court. And all of the forms have been approved by the Supreme Court Administrator's Office for use in all of Michigan's courts.
It's been great learning about your organization. I want to thank Elizabeth Rios, Supervising Attorney for Legal Services of South Central Michigan. I'll bet you're at lsscm.org.
Yes, sir.
Okay, lsscm.org. If you're in need of legal services for civil matters and think you may qualify, you can give them a call, 888-783-8190. Elizabeth, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Mark.
And Current State is looking for more nominations for Neighbors in Action. Email us your suggestions at currentstate@wkar.org. Please put Neighbors in Action in the subject line. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. In the mid-1970s, there was no bigger rock star in the world than Peter Frampton. For years, his live album, Frampton Comes Alive, was the biggest-selling album of all time. He's on tour this summer, including Michigan, and he spoke with Current State's Scott Pohl. What's he up to this year, Scott?
Well, Mark, Peter Frampton has been touring with Lynyrd Skynyrd with a couple of stops planned in Michigan. Those plans went awry a couple of weeks ago when Lynyrd Skynyrd had to postpone a number of shows. Frampton, though, is keeping the date at the DTE Energy Music Theater on Thursday night. It's uncertain if a Friday show at the Soaring Eagle Casino will be rescheduled. I talked with Peter Frampton about his new acoustic album, songwriting, and the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Peter Frampton, welcome to Current State.
Very nice to be here.
Your most recent recording release is made up of studio acoustic renditions of some of your biggest hits. It's called Acoustic Classics. I want to talk to you about it, but first I'd like to give listeners a taste of your live version of Show Me the Way mixed in with your new stripped-down version. Let's listen. Motivated this new acoustic album?
Well, I was thinking of something to do that was a little different. I've always been petrified of doing just acoustic, especially on stage. And so I kind of bit the bullet and decided that not only would the two ideas came up at once, I'd seen a lot of artists do redos of their more popular songs or pieces, and but usually they do them virtually the same because the original version is owned by the record company, and if you recut them, re-record them, then you can own them yourself. So a lot of artists have done that because the record companies are never going to get rid of the masters. They're never going to let you have the masters. And so that's one way of doing it, but I didn't want to do that. I never want to repeat anything like that. It's there, it's done, it's out, you can get it. And for me, I thought, well, a lot of people I've noticed are doing acoustic versions of their songs, and I thought, well, I'll give it a go. And so I have my own studio in Nashville. I'm very lucky, and I was able to go in there and try it out. And it worked for me, and I got very excited about it. And so that's the result is acoustic classics. But in the middle of it, I went out and did the very first me and an acoustic tour called Raw. And it was last October, actually. And I was, as I said, petrified of going out there without my my army of electric guitars and my stack of Marshalls amplifiers. And as soon as I sat down and played the first number, the very first show, I realized this was 180 degrees. It's the same. It's music. It's me performing. It's me enjoying playing. But it's a completely different vibe, 180-degree switch. And it turns into Storytellers meets Unplugged. And I realized that this was something that not only I enjoyed, but the fans really love to hear what goes into what you were thinking when you wrote it, what guitar, what tuning, why you did this, why you did that. And then little stories if you sat down and told me your life story, there would be parts where we would be doubled up in laughter because life is funny. And it's almost the truth is funnier than fiction sometimes and most of the time. So I realized that this was sort of mostly music, but part shrink session with me on the stage and the audience being my doctor. and they loved it. And the more we did it, the more I enjoyed it. And we've done two now. We've done one in October and then we did another one in March and we're planning another one in October. So it's spring and fall are the acoustic tours and summer is me electric with the band. So I'm just loving it. It's so new for me, but obviously every night's different because the stories change and they get longer, they get more. I lie a little bit more each night, so it changes.
Peter Frampton, there's one new song on the album. It's called All Down to Me. Let's hear a little bit of that.
The majority of All Down to Me, my writing partner, Gordon Kennedy, of 16 years now, he's a phenomenal writer, player, singer, but also a very important songwriter. He wrote, was part of the team that wrote Change the World for Eric Clapton. He wrote the last five singles for Bonnie Raitt. The list goes on, but we'd be here all day. But anyway, he's like one of my, if not my best friend. So he's the first person that I call, if I've got something that I just need his expertise to help me just put it over the top. He always does. I mean, whether we start a song together, or he comes in with a complete idea and I put my bit to his. It's a wonderful team. We work many different ways together. So we finished the song off and I just felt that I wanted to have one new song on there so that people knew that, you know, I'm not just sitting. Yes, I'm doing acoustic versions of my older songs, some of which are what I would call deep tracks for some people that they're not familiar with. But most of the more popular songs are on there, too. So, but I did want the one new song on there, and I felt this really was something I felt very good about. And it's kind of using one's... I'm long in the tooth now, and so I hope I have, I know I have a little bit of wisdom and things that I've learned over the years, and how, you know, there's nothing, you can't change your life by people helping you. It's, they can give you advice, but it's you, it's always down to you to change things and get through things. So, you know, that was the essence of the song, that it's really, you've got to look to yourself to get through whatever pain it is or whatever great thing it is. You know, it's all down to you to navigate through this life that we are given as a gift, you know.
We're talking with Peter Frampton. Here's where I'm going to indulge myself in a little looking back. I did see the Frampton Comes Alive tour in Kalamazoo, Michigan, at Wings Stadium. And the thing that struck me at the time, aside from how much fun it was that this is, at that point, already one of the biggest selling, hottest selling live albums ever. Why is he in an arena this small? I could only figure that, you know, it got booked before the album came out and nobody had any idea how big it was going to be.
No, we had some very small venues, comparatively speaking. I had only just started in the end of 75 headlining for the first time, you know. So, in fact, Winterland, where it was recorded, in most of it was recorded in San Francisco, was our very first headline date in San Francisco. So, you know, this was all new territory. But yes, we had various shows booked in small theaters and things like that as our first tryout headline, not realizing that the record was going to, you know, make records. It became, not only was it number one for most of the summer, but it became, by midsummer, it became the biggest selling record of all time. I broke the Tapestry record, Carole King's record, which was also with A&M Records. But so it then, for at least a year there, I was the biggest selling artist in the world, which was scary to say the least.
Well, I will tell you, as a fan of 40 plus years, that it's a shame, a crime, that you're not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Well, thank you. You know, I'm in the Musicians Hall of Fame in Nashville, and to me, I'm with some of my heroes, musicians, they're very incredible musicians, that some of them behind the scenes, even session guys that people don't know, but are the real deal, you know, that have played those solos and played those tracks on all those wonderful songs over the years. But I mean, you know, what is to be will be sure to come true, as my mother used to say. If it's to be, if it's in the cards, then maybe one day, but it's not going to bother me either way, because I'm so lucky to be happy at this stage of my career, so happy doing what I'm doing. And I managed to get a Grammy, which I never thought I would, and I did it for not singing. I did it got it for my instrumental record, Fingerprints. So that was a wonderful kick in the pants, if you know what I mean. It was a very nice feeling, and my peers said yes. And that's enough for me. Anything else for me is just gravy at this point. You know, I guess I'm the Pete Rose of the musicians of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Except I never did gamble on myself.
So you never broke the rules.
Well, I won't say that. I'm sure I did along the way there. But we all do at some point.
Peter Frampton, thank you.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we will talk with reporter Kathleen Gray of the Detroit Free Press. She is in Philadelphia covering the Michigan delegation at the Democratic National Convention. Plus, the Kirtland's Warbler is an icon of northern Michigan with a brilliant yellow breast and distinctive song. The bird makes its home in young jack pines, and it was once on the verge of extinction. But a long-running conservation program is helping restore the Kirtland's population. Kevin Lavery takes us up north in search of this endangered yet beloved bird. That and more Thursday on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Wharf. Katie Cook directed today. Thank you, Katie. Also thanks to Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and to Drew Hill. Stay connected with us on Twitter at KAR Current State. On Facebook, find us at Current State from WKAR. Peter Frampton plays us out on Current State.